Before I start, I should mention my collaborators. I've been working on clusters of galaxies now. I guess in some sense it shows my age, for about almost a decade. And over the years, I have accreted a fair number of a fair number of collaborators. I'll stand right about here. And the work that I'm going to be talking about today is largely done in collaboration with Ian McCarthy, who is a graduate student finishing off and applying out for jobs. He should be, but you see, you know, when Andrea invited me to sunny California, should I say, yeah.
You know, it's already recorded.
What was that?
It's already recorded. It's already recorded.
I have to be a little bit more careful now. So, I mean, the simplest thing about making a cluster is first you need to start with dark matter. And so the standard picture of dark matter works just fine. It fits the bill perfectly well. There's a couple of things about the dark matter distribution that I do want to point out. So this is a density function for the dark matter that the halo, cluster halo that forms hierarchically. This is the NFW profile. Whether you rigidly believe in minus one or not really doesn't matter, and for this particular purpose at hand really doesn't matter. What is interesting, and this is something that Julio and James Taylor have shown, and more recently, Lilia, Julianne Del Canton, and I have been working on it, and we found that when you have a halo, when you collapse a system gravitationally, whether you do it spherically, whether you do a spherical collapse, or whether you do a hierarchical collapse, what the phase space density of the dark matter distribution turns out to have this particular power law, minus 15 over 8. There's a family of solutions. It's a more general solution than, for example, what Julio and James worked out. But I wanted to point this out and draw your attention to it for a reason. It'll become important in the next slide. So we have a dark matter halo that's forming hierarchically, if you will. The density distribution has an NFW-like profile. And the phase space, the coarse grain phase space density, is a power law, literally from the very inside right out to the virial radius. Okay? And the power law is minus 15 over 8. Now, in the standard picture, you would throw gas into this dark matter, or the gas would flow in with the dark matter. And in the absence of any energy transport, you'd expect the gas to trace the dark matter. And if you accept that assertion, then the entropy due to this accretion should be similar, should be related to the phase space density of the dark matter. In other words, rho over sigma cubed, which is the phase space density, is really just kT over NE to the 2/3. This is the proxy for entropy that people have been using when we talk about the intercluster medium. And you can see there's a straight relationship. It's just inverting this thing and raising it to the power 2/3. And that gives you a power law in radius that, for this value of 15 over 8, is equal to 1.25. In numerical simulations, when you check out this quantity, it tends to have a power law that varies between 1.1 and 1.2. We found this quite a while ago, a few years ago, in numerical simulations. And more recently, Greg Bryan, for example, has mentioned that the effective equation of state for gas in clusters is P going as rho to the 1.2. That's related to this thing. From this quantity, I can derive that phase space, that equation of state. And the puzzle was, why was gas tracing this 1.1, 1.2 power law? And we had the data, we just didn't think about looking at until I started working on the dark matter, and then suddenly lights turned on. This is a work that was published in 2000 with Grant Lewis and Neil Katz and Lars and David and company, we plotted the entropy profile, and the entropy profile at outside in the outer half of the cluster, the outer volume regions of the cluster, even in cooling flow clusters, trace this 1.1 profile. There's the dark matter profile plotted in the same units. Now, I'm belaboring this point for a reason, because in the models that I have been working on for the last few years, we started out with this density profile, with this entropy profile in the outer regions, and then modified the entropy profile in the inner regions. And the first natural question, if you're in the audience, is, well, why did you make that assumption? Why did you assume 1.1 in the outer regions? So now we have an answer. We can actually explain it. Now, in a more realistic simulations, shocks and stirring by infalling objects tends to make the gas in the inner regions more isothermal, and you see that you break away from this 1.1, and the entropy profile tends to flatten. That's just basically the fact that the gas in the inner, within R500, is becoming isothermal. This is the standard picture, and the standard picture, as you probably already know, and I gather there have been people here who've given talks on this already, the standard picture does not account for the global trends in the X-ray, or SZ for that matter. So I've just quickly run through some of the correlations. This is the standard LT relationship. The standard model predicts this blue line right here. It has a power law behavior at high temperatures, going as luminosity scaling as temperature squared. The observations, the data scales as T to the roughly 3. And the mass, the total mass temperature relationship, or the gas mass temperature relationship, similarly have a slightly different slope. In the standard model, you get mass going as temperature to the 1.5. The observations show a trend that's something like 1.7 or 1.8. And there's also an offset. There's an offset between the predictions of this self-similar model, where the gas has only been heated up by accretion shocks. I guess I haven't put on my SZ results, but the same features are apparent in the SZ plots, where if you plot up either the integrated SZ Compton-Y parameter or the Compton-Y parameter through the center and correlated against temperature. And in the present case, we're using X-ray temperature, but with SZA, you'll actually be able to do this without having to resort to X-ray data. But the data that we got from John Kallstrom when we plotted it up against the correlations that we computed from both the regular model and the preheated model just fit the trends. The standard model was off. For those of you, five of you who were in the audience here when I gave this talk, was down here in May. I showed you that plot, if you may remember. I might actually come back to it in a sec, further down.
Ari?
Yeah.
My recollection of the earlier discussion of that discrepancy was that there was a clear break. Forget the offset; that's a different issue. But mm-hmm. There was a clear break in the slope at of order a couple of keV or a few keV. So that for things that were high temperature, where metal line contributions
was not important.
Are not important.
Yep.
That the standard slope was okay, and that it was where you reach the temperature regime where metal lines were important that there was a discrepancy.
Right. So that break actually wasn't present in the mass temperature relationships, but is present, for example, in the LT diagram. If you take the data at face value, and the reason I'm not emphasizing it is because there is still concern that the group data, where you do see the break, is highly incomplete. Nobody has a well-defined catalog of groups. So, I could beat this horse as well, because our model fits whatever Pohnmann has given us up to this point in time. But I'm not sure it's worthwhile. But here's the break. You see, in the observations, I mean, there is an offset, but even apart from the offset, there is this temperature to the 3 for the massive clusters, and then you go temperature to almost 4.5, 4.7. In the standard model, Now, remember, the L going as T squared has been calculated assuming Bremsstrahlung only. So if you want to play the same game for the standard model, then what you want to do is also put in line cooling. And that actually drives you in the opposite direction. It goes as L goes as T. So in fact, the discrepancy becomes more apparent rather than less apparent. So now, what I am going to do is be bold and give you my answer to this whole problem, and then I'll start working through it. Now, when I start working through it, I'll be honest, and I'll tell you where I think I need to do a little bit more work. The picture that I have in mind, and that's sort of come over the last year or so that we've been working sufficiently, we worked out the model in sufficient detail that I think this is the way things are going to shape up. I am going to assert that even before the cluster forms, in regions where you have high densities of galaxies, you're going to affect the lowest entropy gas. This is a gas that is in groups, for example, or in cluster halos. They are going to be affected. That's the gas that would eventually contribute the lowest entropy gas in the clusters. So really, that's all I want to affect. I just want to disrupt that particular component of the gas. That's not hard because we know that that's, you know, that there is, well, I'll come back to it in a second, but I'm going to argue that that's a generic feature of the universe that we live in. Once you have gas that's been preheated, you can have collapse going forward. And again, I will, in this picture, assert that you can have a variation of energy inputs. So in other words, from cluster region to cluster region, the energy input likely varies. You don't have a universal constant. Now, if you have a very low energy input, then you form a cluster. That cluster is going to look very much like what was classically called cooling flow clusters. And here, I'm not going to use the label cooling flow in its physical meaning, in the sense that it's a model where mass is flowing to the center, but rather as a label that describes a morphological type of clusters where you have a strongly peaked X-ray emission peaking towards the center, and the temperature is declining towards the center. Okay, so it's more an empirical definition. Well, these are the systems that have low levels of heating. They can cycle through this phase. You can have, if you can have, as the system settles down, you will have mass flowing back into the center. And if you have an AGN in the center, you can then recycle this. The system can go on and off, on and off, on and off. So this is one part of the picture. If you have a high level of heating, then the system ends up in a state that is much more akin to the non-cooling flow clusters. These are clusters that have a characteristic beta profiles, large cores, about 150 kiloparsecs, very flat X-ray surface brightness densities reaching into the center. These systems are not going to do anything, as I will show you. They'll just exist in that state. These other systems, the low energy input systems, the cooling flow-like systems, they have a possibility where when the mass starts flowing back into the center and you have a secondary feedback from AGNs in the center there, you could again have heating that will shut it off but leave it in the low energy state. It'll then settle down and you'll have a mass flow again and heating again. Or you could also have a possibility where that secondary heating is sufficiently large that it drives it up here. I've marked this line out in a dashed line because I'm going to argue that that's highly unlikely. The reason being that in variables, you know, in terms of heating, what you want to do is you want to be able to heat the gas and drive the gas density in the center down so that you can suppress cooling. You drive the density down far enough that cooling time scales become long. In order to do that, once the cluster is formed, you need really large amounts of energy. In pre-collapse mode, you can get away by doing this because the mean the density in this cluster region, say it's few times background, but it's not, you know, it's not 1,000 times the background, it's not 100 times background. So therefore, it's easier to do it here and get kicked into this regime, but harder to go through this regime and then get kicked up here. It may be possible. I just think that it's going to be unlikely. So the first question is, you know, that I encounter is, why heating? We've heard, there have been papers published that cooling by itself can get rid of your low entropy gas and therefore bring everything back into agreement. And if, you know, if you take, for example, Mark Voigt and Greg Bryan, early models where they simply put down a cluster, they went in, let us just throw away all the low entropy gas, just truncate it. They call it the truncated cooling model. They ended up with an LTE plot that looked remarkably like our preheated model. And this was a main argument that said that, well, you didn't need to do this, right? Why go through the preheating when simply doing following cooling, which we know is occurring, can take care of the problem? Well, it turns out that cooling by itself has several problems in its own right. The first is this truncated model of cooling where you just take the cold low entropy gas out and throw it away is just not realistic. So if you go through the process of actually setting up a halo and let it evolve, then what happens is that you have an inward flow of material, you have compression, you will have cooling efficiencies will increase, and in fact the system drives ends up down here. It looks very much like your standard isothermal model as opposed to the truncated cooling model which agreed in with data. So that's one problem, that you actually, when you do this in a physically meaningful way, the cooling model by itself does not solve your problem. And this is another way of looking at that. If you start with a model that has some profile and let cooling take place, then basically the cluster, these are clusters of different masses, clusters basically start tracking down towards brighter luminosities until you start running out of gas. When you run out of gas, luminosity starts going down. So you get this turnaround track. It's not a, I'm not going to belabor this point for the reasons I will just come to in a second. This is, so we've done it, but this work was also, this type of discussion is also present in Peng's paper, for example, with Andrew Benson. The reason I didn't want to belabor that turnaround point is that if you have cooling taking place, and cooling is proceeding, you're getting rid of the low entropy gas, but that low entropy gas is going somewhere. And it's going, either it's sitting there in the form of cold gas, or it's turning into stars. So you can immediately ask the question, well, if I did this and I calculated the fraction of cold gas or cold baryons versus the total baryons I started with, or fraction of cold baryons versus the hot that I left over, what is the fraction? And you find that in this dynamic cooling model, you have a rising curve where the values reach as high as 40% on group scales. The observed value, at least at present, across the entire mass range, there seems to be no mass dependence, is about it's basically about 5%. Now, it could be as high as 10%, but again, you see that this trend drives you quite high on the group scales at low mass scales. And that is a problem in its own right. We saw this when we did our numerical simulations, again, going back to Lewis et al. This was our first attempt at starting this cluster project, Neil and I. We did this numerical simulation. Everything looked great, except for the fact that we had 30% in stars. And we couldn't figure out, I mean, we realized immediately that we needed feedback. Now, this simulation had stars as feedback. And that kind of feedback was just not enough to stop this kind of cooling from going on. And that problem has been repeated, has been described by many people subsequently. I think Peng mentioned it in his paper. Andrews mentioned it. Andrews mentioned it in the context of forming galaxies. Evans, I think you guys have also raised that issue in your paper on forming galaxies in groups. You have these elliptical galaxies in groups where you have tremendous amount of cooling going on. These galaxies just keep growing more and more. They become gigantic luminous systems. You then do not agree with the galaxy luminosity function. So if you want, even at the galaxy formation level, if you want agreement with the galaxy luminosity function, you need to quench this heating, this cooling. Now, cooling...
In the earlier discussion of clusters in which people thought there were cooling flows, the same problem at least the description, it sounds like this problem was encountered. What is actually different now?
Nothing was...
There the statement was that there can't be cooling flows because the cooling implied by the cooling flow would lead to too much cold baryonic matter, and we don't see the stars that should have been the product of that cooling. What's different now?
I think the question turns around the other way. If you talked to the theorist, the small group of theorists, the argument that you've just posed was the accepted argument, right? But if you went beyond and talked to the X-ray observers, the argument was that no cooling is taking place and the mass is there. And even as recently as, you know, until Chandra came up with its results where the temperature plateaued at 3 keV, the argument was still there that cooling is going on. And Andy Fabian has tons of papers where he has come up with a variety of different ways of hiding the mass. And that's what the exercise was, that, you know, there's molecular clouds in small fragments, so you're not picking them up. You know, there's star formation going on at a 10% level. Well, you know,
are those arguments no longer necessary?
They aren't necessary because certainly when these group of people have started working on galaxy formation, this, you know, even people who do these... it was first realized by people like Rachel and Andrew when they were doing their semi-analytic formation of galaxies that they were missing out on the brightest end. They were producing too many large, very bright systems. And the problem was that there was just much too efficient a cooling going on group scales. So, I think what's happening is that Chandra result has convinced the X-ray community that this is indeed what's happening, and the theorists have more or less just come to a consensus that was already there. It's just more people are agreeing to it. Now, you can quench cooling by heating, obviously. If you heat the gas, as I mentioned, you drive the density down, you increase the cooling time. And this is a plot that's from a paper by Mark Voigt that illustrates that if you had a system with a, say, 1 keV temperature, and you heat that gas, you give it a minimum entropy, it raise the lowest entropy gas up to an entropy of order about 100, then what happens is that the gas gets driven out of the deepest part of the potential, and as its density goes down, the cooling time increases to longer than 15 billion years. In clusters, you actually need to increase the entropy much higher, as high as 300, before you can quench this cooling. Now, when you do the heating model, and this is a game that I've been playing for the longest time, and I could give you an entire talk just on this, but I don't want to. I have more interesting things to talk about. In summary, heating gets the mean trends. So there's our model where we had a preheating going on at a level of about 400, between 300 and 400, and we basically capture not just the large massive clusters, but at that time we were also quite happy about the fact that we captured groups. So you can see that trend happening there. The red line here is the mass temperature relationship. You see that, again, the trend is steeper than the standard model. So we are capturing both the index of 1.7 as well as the amplitude. This is velocity dispersion times luminosity. Here, mind you, the scatter in the data is so large that you can fit just about anything through it and it'll look good. The only thing to bear in mind is that the one thing that doesn't fit or look good is the standard model, which is the blue curve down there. Right. Apart from that, there's not much else you can say. This is the X-ray data, where this is the Compton Y parameter through the center of clusters. This is the X-ray temperature, and this is data that was given to us by Rees and Karlstrom. And these different lines are just models of different entropy calculated at two different redshifts, because the clusters had a pretty large distribution in redshift. The standard model is here. The data is all in the direction of higher entropy. And in fact, the scatter in the data is so large that if you wanted to capture the scatter, you might be tempted to think that you need entropies as high as 500. And when we first saw this, as you can imagine, we were already getting flack for demanding that we need an entropy of 300 to 400, which comes out to something like 3 to 5 keV per baryons. That was already high. this 500 would be sort of pushing the envelope.
Arifin, you're assuming a constant entropy, I mean, dependently on mass or temperature. So you're preheating the gas at the same level, the same entropy, for on group scale and cluster scale, in the previous curve.
In that curve, yeah, that's right. It was the same level, yeah. The interesting side benefit of trying, of getting the, you know, so I didn't show you the, I showed you the mass temperature, but I didn't show you the mass luminosity, which we also get. The interesting side benefit of getting these correlations is that you can also simultaneously have a theoretical model that gets both the temperature function and the luminosity function for the X-ray clusters. Up to this point in time, that's not been possible. You either get the temperature function or you get the luminosity function, just because the mass temperature or the mass luminosity are off. Now, why consider preheating as a starting point? Well, as I indicated, the epoch of quasar and galaxy formation precedes cluster formation, and you expect that if there are AGNs going off, the outflows will heat the surrounding IGM. And you would expect that these the AGN feedback, as I mentioned already, is necessary if you want to quench the brightest, quench the growth of the brightest ellipticals. So that's already suggesting that there's something interesting going on, certainly on group scales. And the other thing that we would like, I would just like to mention, is that I'm not advocating a mass heating of the IGM. I'm not saying that we need to go out and basically destroy the whole of the IGM. What I am interested in is regions where there is the strongest galaxy concentrations. These are the regions that will eventually form groups and clusters. So we're looking at localized energy injections, localized on scales of protoclusters. It's not surprising. These are the systems where you have the largest number of bulge galaxies or spheroidal galaxies. And if there's a, given the correlation between spheroidal population and black hole populations, these are the regions where you expect to have the most amount of activity going on. Now, this is a postulate. This is one thing that I've spent some time talking to some of you around here. I'm trying to wrap my mind around this. I am convinced that I need to have a variation in heating of the gas from cluster to cluster, and I can argue just sort of naively that, you know, you can expect differences in star formation history or even the timing, just the fact that when the energy is dumped relative to how dense the system is, that can change the entropy. And also you would expect that if there's variations in energy output from black hole to black hole, so if you have a, you know, an advection flow where you have no outputs coming in but mass is still going on, that's one extreme. The other is that you could have as much as 0.1 or 0.2 of Eddington coming out. So there's a, you know, one, my gut tells me that there you expect this variations. How to put this in a nice package is something that I need to work out. That's sort of the next thing on my list of priorities. Basically, what you have is that when you preheat, you are basically taking the gas that has the lowest entropy, the entropy below the threshold that you would like system to be, and raising it up. The simplest way to think about it is that the final entropy of the gas is the initial entropy plus the entropy you generate through shocks. So if you have a higher, if you have zero initial entropy, then all your entropy is coming through shocks, and you get this kind of a curve. If you have if the lowest entropy gas has already been kicked up, then as it falls in, it's not going to get shocked as dramatically. First of all, sound speeds go up, so you're not going to shock it. But the simplest way to think about it is it's just going to have a plateau. You can't decrease entropy, at least without radiative cooling. So you're going to have a plateau at the entropy level that you've set it in the preheating phase, and then the rest of the gas will basically just pick up entropy as it's falling in, and the shock entropy will dominate. So there's no problem with that. Now, gas in clusters will lose energy via cooling. And the impact of cooling will depend on two things: preheating level, for the reasons I've already explained, and time available for cooling. Now, the time available for cooling is something that one could argue depends on cluster formation. What we're trying to grapple with is exactly what we mean by cluster formation. So that's another issue, but it's not a major issue here for the reasons I will show you. Here's the entropy profile of a system that we've taken and preheated with varying degrees. So this is entropy of minimum entropy of 100, 200, right up to 500. We then allow the system to cool. What you see is that with entropy of 100 or 200, the system starts to cool very quickly. It's still sufficiently dense in the center that it just radiates away all that energy, and it returns back to its stable equilibrium phase, which is this power law. I'll come back to why it's a power law in a second too. If you heat the gas up to sufficiently high entropies, 400, 500, then you see that you do get an effect of cooling taking place, but it never completely drops out. The core, which you can see from this kink right here, the core hasn't disappeared. It's still there. And at 500, it's even more present. This is a 1D hydrocode, yeah.
Oh, 1D hydrocode.
Yeah. You can go ahead and calculate what the cold fraction is, and you see that if you have a minimum of 200, then you start suppressing the inflow significantly, and at 500 you get nothing. Okay, so you can certainly get around the, if you want to make sure that you are not overproducing stars, then that indicates something like a minimum of 200. And well, I've put in a number like 500, but you'll see for a second why 500 was we were playing with. You can already see an indication from our SZ results. Yeah.
Why is there a peak at intermediate mass and not you didn't just suppress the?
Sorry, where's the peak at
As you go from S of 100.
It's a time thing, so it's moving in this direction. Cooling starts here, but you can see this is time curve, so it's a wave that's moving outward. It's moving in this direction towards lower masses. But as the cooling starts occurring in lower masses, it becomes much more efficient and runs away faster. The same thing happens. The temperature profiles and the surface brightness profiles show features that reflect what I've just described to you. I'll just focus on the surface brightness. You start with the 500. You start with a density profile that's been preheated. That's the red curve here. It's flat, it's very, very much similar to a beta profile. As you allow cooling to take place, in situations where cooling is very efficient, you quickly build up a strong peak in the center. Now, these curves are starting to look like non-cooling flows and cooling flow systems.
So the temperature profiles, as you know, in a lot of, most of the simulations, you predict something that rises towards the center, whereas in observations it becomes isothermal, it looks isothermal even falls.
Yeah, so the non-cooling flow system seem to have an isothermal distribution.
Yeah.
Now this rising profile does flatten somewhat. I haven't plotted a projected temperature profile here. The projection does flatten things a little bit, but you're right, there's still a little bit of a problem there. I was talking to Ramesh last week, and he was suggesting that the mild rise that we still see in the projected temperature could be erased if we put in conduction. So this time, conduction not to flow energy in, but to flow the energy out. So that's something Ian was playing with just as I left. Now, I mentioned the cooling flow versus non-cooling flow clusters. I thought I might as well show you what they look like. So here you see the data that you can see in red is the surface brightness profile for Abel 1413. And here the faint dotted line is the surface brightness profile for Abel 2052. I've just picked them out. These are two systems that are characteristic of the non-cooling flow versus cooling flow. For the non-cooling flow systems, as Peng just mentioned, you have this particular profile in temperature that as you come towards the center, at some point you start declining and the temperature goes down as you go towards the cluster center. There is a puzzle in the systems that the temperature stabilizes at about one-third of the virial temperature. It doesn't drop very much. That would fit into my last bit, where if you had temperature got too cold, you would start flowing mass in, and then the AGN would feed back again. So we're working that bit out. But for the calculations I've done so far in terms of X-ray correlation, fixing this bit of the problem is just optics. It's not going to change anything on the large scale, on the large scales in the cluster. Now, with that in mind, let me go back to the luminosity temperature relationship. The luminosity temperature relationship that I had plotted earlier and the luminosity temperature relationship that you will see in literature over the last decade and a half is what's often referred to as cooling flow corrected, and it's usually a sentence somewhere in the paper. Well, what they do is they go in and they'll take out the central region. Either they'll smooth it out or they'll take it out or do something, depending on whose data you're looking at, it varies from person to person. It took us a year to get somebody's data, which I would call what you see is what you get data. Okay, and Don Horner, Richard Mushotsky's former student, has a very nice compilation where he calculates temperatures and luminosities of systems and gives you what you see is what you get. We plotted that up and rediscovered, for example, in the temperature luminosity plane, the reason why the cooling flows were thrown out is that the scatter increases. So if you want a nice tight correlation, you actually want to get rid of that central region. And interestingly enough, that central region, excising that central region, moves these clusters over. So the effect is that you unfurl the LT relationship, you spread it out a little bit, and the spreading is occurring mostly due to systems that are exhibiting this peaked central features. And we then went ahead and took the old definitions from Alistair Edge's paper and Andy Fabian's paper, where they had calculated M dots for all the systems. So any system that had M dot greater than 300, we've plotted as squares with circles. Any system that had M dots between 100 and 300 are just ordinary squares. And any system that they say had no significant cooling flows, which are systems less than 30 solar masses per year, are triangles. And you see that there's a nice structure there. This is not random scatter. There's actually structure in the LT plane. We've then go ahead and tried to do this with new definitions where we take the XMM or Chandra data and look to see whether the thing has a temperature profile that's declining towards the center and centrally peaked X-ray surface brightness, because after all, we know this M dot thing is now crap. And when we did that, we found that there's a bias in the data. People have gone out and looked at the sexiest clusters, which are the brightest, most luminous, the centrally concentrated. There isn't a homogeneous data set out there of clusters. I mean, it's underway. I think Thomas Reiprich is now finally getting around to doing this. And when he does, it'll be very, very interesting, because for the few clusters that we were able to find, so we reproduced the cooling flow trend, and we were starting to get a few clusters that fill out the upper edge that are indeed non-cooling flow systems. Very few of them exist in the Chandra database. But we also went ahead and went one step further and actually looked at the X-ray image carefully to see if we could see substructure. So if we saw substructure, we didn't want to deal with the system. In other words, what we wanted to, the first argument that I got from Andy was that, non-cooling flows are just clusters that have undergone mergers. They've just been hit, so they've been disrupted. So we wanted to find systems that were relaxed non-cooling flow systems, and there are a few. You can see that there are a few. There are not many, but that's because there just isn't any data there. You also see non-relaxed non-cooling flow systems, and you also see, interestingly enough, non-relaxed cooling flow systems. In other words, there are cooling flow systems where there are active substructures. Perseus is an example of this. There are three subclusters coming into Perseus. And you ask, well, why hasn't Perseus been destroyed? Well, because the core is really dense and doesn't get disrupted that easily. So the argument becomes a tautology. Anyways, more data will be really good in this direction. But even with what we have, we did the same thing with the mass luminosity. You see the same kind of structures coming out. Interestingly enough, when you do the same thing on the temperature plot, mass temperature plot, you actually do not get dramatic amounts of scatter. The scatter in the luminosity is a factor of 10 at a given mass. It's only a factor of 2 scatter in temperatures, and most of that scatter of factor 10, factor 2 can be attributed to systematics from instrument to instrument. So ASCA, for example, gets one measurement for a given cluster. ROSAT has another measurement. So once we get more reliable temperature measurements coming in from XMM, that hopefully that scatter will actually tighten up. In fact, we don't expect any scatter, a significant scatter in the temperature plot. Going back to our models, if you take the models with different heating levels and then start cooling them, so this the solid green line here is zero cooling, and then you allow cooling to take place for a Hubble time, so that's the hatched region. What you start to see is that with 200, you can basically span the lower half of the LT diagram, but you can't capture the upper half. If you want to explain the upper half of the LT scatter, you need to start going to higher and higher entropies. And that makes sense because the non-cooling flow systems are the ones that are sitting up there. They are the systems with flat tops. And if you want to get a flat top, then you really need high entropies to begin with. So in terms of understanding the trends and the physical relationship between the model and the position on the LT diagram, this all starts to fit together. No, that's right. But we were, you know, at some point, and this goes back to the question that you raised when we were talking yesterday, right? At which point you cut it off. And you can see there is evidence for going up. We just decided we were going to rankle enough people with this. We didn't want to go too far. So I've showed you the mass temperature, mass luminosity. I can do the same thing with the LT diagram and get virtually the same kinds of results. In other words, if you want to cover the entire plane in the LT or the ML diagram, you basically are driven to the conclusion that you need a range of entropy levels. And that fits in because the range of entropy levels also makes sense with respect to the physics that's going on in the clusters. Some are cool, some have centrally peaked centrally peaked X-ray surface brightness and a temperature that's declining, others don't. Now, we went one step further and looked at the core radii. So accepting the fact that the clusters cannot be fit by a simple ordinary beta profile, it's too simple, we can still go ahead and do it and use that to get a measure of the core radii. So we've plotted up here data where you consider systems with core radii of 60, 60, 250, and then or greater than 150. And again, you see that, as you would expect, this is just another reflection of the surface brightness profile trends, that there is structure. The smallest core radii systems sit down here. They're the cooling flow systems. And the systems with the largest core radii are sitting up here. We could go ahead and do that with our models. So we have data here. We then go ahead, so the blue dots in this plot, the color scheme has slightly changed here. The blue dots are the non-cooling flow, the reds are the cooling flow, and the green dots are our models. So we have a slew of models that are then allowed to cool, and as they cool, they trace out this particular locus of points. And you can see that with the highest entropy, you're basically in the zone dominated by the blue systems. But as you go to lower entropies like 200, you start out up here, and as the trail extends with time, you end up in the zone where the cooling flow systems are sitting. So not only can you start to understand the global relationships of clusters like the LT and ML, but now you can start to make sense of the structural properties, like the details of the surface brightness profiles and things like core radii that are present in the surface brightness profile. The final main point that I'd like to throw at you is, of course, I'm talking about preheating, and what you'd really like to see is entropy. Now, here's the entropy profile of the models. Just to remind you how things are changing and how they're evolving, if you have high entropy, you're not going to change very much. If you have low entropy, you're going to end up in this power law mode. This is data from Chandra and XMM, entropy profiles of clusters that we could get our hands on. The blue lines represent the cooling flow systems, the reds the non-cooling flow systems. I want to mention one thing, that we have selected systems that do not have substructure here. So, you know, there's this 3C129, looks like it has a pretty high entropy. Visually, an X-ray observer would classify this as a relaxed system. Now, you could go in and look at ripples and things like that, but all of them have ripples and things like that. Even Perseus has ripples in them. But it has nice, circularly symmetric X-ray contours, and there is no evidence of a secondary clump anywhere. So we have systems that are starting to span a range of entropy levels. The range of profiles here are starting to resemble a distribution that's a combination of these. The only thing is the non-cooling flow systems, there's too sparse a data set, and it'd be nice to start filling it in. And I think this is going to be an interesting test of the model.
So once you get rid of the high
the cluster X-ray luminosity. Yeah. So in fact, it'll be increasing as you're going down this way.
So when you plot the LXTS relation with the final result matching the sort of self-similar entropy profile,
yeah,
you still get the answer.
So your question is, if I understood you correctly, you're saying that if I start with something and I allow it to cool, it's going to go down in this direction.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So what's the question then?
So can you still agree with observations?
Those are there.
These are observations. So my argument is that if you have variations of heating from cluster to cluster, then the high entropy systems are going to capture the upper half of the scatter plane. The low entropy systems are going to capture the lower half, and the range of cooling times will do the rest for you.
Okay.
Now, if I could, you know, I could tie the range of cooling times to say the formation epoch, and that's we're basically starting to now put this physics. Now that we think we understand the physics, we're now starting to put it into a semi-analytic machinery to see what kind of population we can generate.
Can I ask you another question? Let's assume this is very negative. Let's assume I don't believe your preheating. So, you know, no entropy, no 500 kV per centimeter cube, etc. So, what's the alternative? You want to explain the data.
Yeah.
So, you know, somebody that is building other models, would they say it's happening towards the upper end of that envelope?
Let me come back to that in a second, because I mean we've tried to do that. I'm going to skip this since I'm running out of time. So the final thing is, so I've gotten you to this step, and the question is then, what happens to these systems? These are just going to remain. What are going to happen to this system? Well, it's the same kind of physics that's happening up here that I have left vague, but I'm starting to argue that this is where you have feedback, where you have flow into an AGN, and you have feedback going on. We see evidence of that happening, right? In almost all of the cooling flow systems, you have bubbles that are being blown in the very centers. And so the argument here is that there's several models for how the energy is being dissipated. One argument is that the bubbles, as they rise through buoyancy, the viscous interactions between the bubble wall and the IGM surrounding it dissipates energy into the IGM. The other is that there is there's different forms of heating. The basic generic sort of rubric is that there is effervescent heating. You have bubbles rising and the bubbles are then heating. My argument is that's fine. As long as you have an AGN in the center, you're going to see this. But I don't think that the level of heating here is going to be high enough to kick you into the non-cooling flow state. Now, you raise this point of what happened, you know, what other ways are there of trying to generate? And the one thing that we have started looking at, only because traditionally the tacit belief is the way to generate this scatter is through mergers. So let me show you the requisite pretty movie. This is a movie of our Virgo cluster forming, except what we're mapping out here is the gas, not the dark matter. So the picture is that as you have these gas-rich systems colliding with each other, you will very quickly start to see, if you look in here, shock waves forming and ripples coming out. And the argument is that the central regions, when they get hit by something massive, is going to get disrupted. And the disruption is going, there you go. So the argument there is that this kind of disruption will scatter you up. And the answer is, and we've started to look at this problem, because ultimately we need to deal with mergers as well.
Scatter you up in the
so it'll scatter you up in the LT diagram, because what it'll do is it'll blow away the cold core. Right? The argument is that you'll get some other system, it'll ram, and the shock heating will then cause the gas to expand out. Now, we're starting to look at it, but there are about five pieces of work, five theoretical studies of mergers that you can find on ADS. And the interesting thing is that the conclusions that they come to are extremely confusing. They're all over the place. There is a paper, for example, that argues that mergers where you have a cold core in the incoming system will actually deposit its cold core in the center and give you a higher cold central region. There are others that say that you will collide and you will scatter. What we are finding, and we've started doing this, is that first of all, you need 3-to-1 mergers to do any significant damage. And this is like galaxies. You find similar kinds of ratios in galaxies. The second thing is, and this is more interesting, you do scatter the cold cooling flow systems up into that upper envelope region. But they don't stay there very long. They stay there for about 2 gigayears before they drop down. So in other words, and remember, I am not asking for systems that are disrupted or look disrupted. I'm asking for a subset of systems that are in the upper envelope that really do look relaxed. So if I was to take a snapshot of it and make a beta profile of it, it would look like a non-cooling flow system with no collisions going on. Those kinds of systems only last for about 2 gigayears. So you need to have a continuous scattering of systems going up to span the upper envelope. Today, that I think is going to be troublesome. This is a possibility. So we're looking at it, but it's going to be possible. It's going to be rare because 3-to-1 or greater interactions are already at the 10% level. And so you start with something that's only happening 10% of the time, and will only last for a fraction of the total interaction time. So the duty cycle is very short. But this is the only thing I could think of that would do it.
It could have mechanical friction.
It doesn't do enough. So you're talking about stirring.
Yeah.
I mean, I worked this out, you know, even before when I was at Columbia, and when Mark was at Columbia and I was at NYU. I worked this out because a lot of the people who did this work were at Columbia. So we sat down and worked it out, and I wasn't convinced that it's enough. On an individual system, you could have a large group coming in, and it'll do your M squared heating in the center. But you need lots of these groups, and you need to counteract cooling. See, Mark's paper does not take into account radiative cooling. Same thing in this game, right? So if you kick it up to entropy of 300 and have no cooling, you're fine. But if you have 300 of entropy and you allow for cooling to take place, then you can't ever get up to that upper envelope.
No, but there's a big enough energy reservoir in the galaxies, right? If they have their dark matter halos attached, then, you know, as the gas cools, then they'll transfer heat to the gas.
No, that's my argument, that you actually don't have as much.
If you just consider the stellar mass, that's absolutely true. But if you add the dark matter,
you're not going to offset cooling. That's my argument. It's not that you don't have enough energy there. It's that you're not going to offset, you cool fast too. So you're not going to offset cooling.
The energy transfer rate will match the cooling rate because the sound speed will drop, and so the energy transfer rate will shoot up as well.
Yeah, but the equilibrium solution is not going to be a flat core. The equilibrium solution will still be a steep core. So if you want to do that, you can have cooling flow systems that can hang on to their cooling flow profiles, their steep density profiles. But to really quench the system, you need to drive it down. So you need to deposit a lot of energy to drive the sound speed up.
But, okay.
Yeah, we can talk about that. So anyways, to finish off, the heating level at a minimum of 200 is needed to prevent excessive cooling of baryons. Radiative cooling in the central region, interestingly enough, in the systems, which I didn't discuss, also establishes R to the 1.1. This is different from the R to the 1.1 that you have on the outside. And here I can change it. If you give me a different gravitational potential, I can actually change. So this is a feature that's related to an NFW-like profile. You can actually derive this in Birchinger's paper. He doesn't actually go ahead and do it, but if you take his solutions and solve it, you find that the entropy profile is related, one, to the temperature dependence of the cooling function, and B, to the local power law of the gravitational potential. And that's all it is. It's a combination of that. Depending on the entropy injection and the time that's elapsed, you can actually cover a range of scatter in almost all of the observed quantities. You have a mild entropy at 200, will end up giving you what's called the peak profiles, the peak clusters. High entropy will give you flat cores. And we've started to talk about, I just mentioned briefly this heating versus merger hypothesis, and that's something that we're trying to demonstrate in a more quantitative sense, that this will not work, not at the level that you need. So variations in entropy injection can also account for these other correlations in the cluster. And interestingly enough, you can also start to get the core radii distributions in clusters. And then my final concluding point is that, at least as it stands right now, the model is testable. If we find that the clusters that are non-cooling flow and relaxed do not have the entropy profiles of the kind that we are predicting, then we're dead in water. Or until I come up with a more creative idea. So I'll stop there.
Thank you very much. We have time for questions, please.
Yeah. So in 200 for heating, then what is expected to solve before the crust?
Sorry, can you repeat your question?
What is the preheating source?
It has to be AGNs. You cannot get any of these levels of heating from stars.
Does that have to happen before cluster collapse?
It's 200 if you do it before cluster collapse. Yes, because, well, let me rephrase that. It's optimal to do it before cluster collapse because the density is low and so you don't need as much energy. You can get the same levels in, as Piero was telling you. In principle, you can extract large amounts of energy out of an AGN. So you could do it post-collapse. It's just, I think it's going to be, it doesn't fit into the standard numbers that people throw around for efficiencies.
Well, incidentally, the quasar era is at 0.2 degrees.
Yeah.
Then that's where you would expect, if it's AGN,
yeah,
you would expect to get most of your heating.
Yeah, and I think that fits in nicely because that's, yeah, and that fits in nicely because that's right around the just before the turnaround time for clusters themselves.
Okay. So, Arif, are you worried about the properties of massive galaxies? I mean, they're so regular, right? Fundamental plane. If you have a huge scatter and this feedback, and that's what's setting the massive end, you think the scatter might mess up, you know, what you're getting in the Bose population? I don't know.
I haven't. I mean, the fundamental plane relationship is coming from the stars in the system. So if you had, if you had a system where you have gas cools, and as it starts flowing down, you immediately trigger another outburst, then you're only affecting the gas properties. You're never forming more stars. You're never getting to a regime where you actually form a significant number of stars before this thing happens. So then I'm not sure why it would affect the fundamental plane relationship.
If we believe those downsizing costs, all really old.
Yeah. So,
but
I'm just saying, if
AGNs
keeping a group
from
becoming a big elliptical, and infinite
of the AGN varied by factors of 3 and 4, you might think that properties of big ellipticals would vary a lot, but naively.
Well, you know, in the systems that I have, the reason I sort of emphasize that minimum of 200 is because that's the case where you actually it takes a while before you have a mass flow in. Now, what I had asked Ian to calculate, and he wasn't able to send the plot to me in time, otherwise I'd have included it. I wanted him to calculate what m dot is for our system. So m dot is related to the slope of the power law slope. So the entropy, the, I've been speaking for too long. It's related to the power law index of the entropy, right? So it starts out flat in the core and it starts to steepen as you allow cooling to take place. And the question that I have is m dot all sort of peaked right as it settles into r to the 1.1, or is it gradually building up? If it's gradually building up, then we're screwed. Screwed in the sense that the issue that you've raised becomes a problem. If it all if it suddenly peaks as you get to that 1.1, then you actually get a nice result that you will have clusters that reach that power law. And just as they reach the power law, they start flowing mass in, you get a feedback, and the feedback shuts off the mass flow. Then you never get m dot going. Even in the systems where you allow for peaked clusters, you never get m dot going. So I'm actually keeping my fingers crossed and hoping that, you know, the model works out. That would be a very neat result. Yeah.
I mean, if I was curious about the limit on the coal gas from Ballard, right? So a limit on what gas from what phase? Because I'm thinking, it's true that if you have cooling, you would expect, generally speaking, that the gas goes into star. On the other hand, I think even the highly turbulent environment that you have in the center of the cluster is very hard for bright stars to form because it's just too violent, right? So the gas could be trapped in some, you know, strange multi-phase regime that you can't see, kind of observe. So the limits that are coming from Ballard are...
They're from two sources. They are one from the stars, and there's a minor secondary contribution from molecular gas that Alistair Edge has seen in clusters.
Suppose the gas is all in 10 to the 4 K phase.
Yes, yeah. So that was one of the pictures that Andy had, for example, when he was trying to hide the cooling gas, you know, that it was in little cloudlets. And my recollection is that for one of the clusters, I can't remember whether it was Perseus or not, I thought David Weinberg and Jacqueline Van Gorkum tried to look for this gas, because the idea was that not only you have an ionized gas, but you still have a small amount of H1, and they tried to look for it and couldn't find it. So that was one, the only thing that I know where somebody's made an effort to try and find that kind of a mass.
Well, even here it's 10 to the 4, it's ionized.
Yeah, then it becomes very difficult to see. Yeah.
The thing is, you see it in H alpha because it'll be surrounded by, you know, the ionized by nearby brand. So there's a lot of it you see in H alpha.
That's what I was saying. Yeah. What type of limits are the other one? Because are there limits on the H alpha?
So you do see
there are.
Elements,
yeah.
You do see them.
Yeah.
So
you see them in Perseus, for example.
It's
tiny. And not only is it tiny, it's also seen in very specific geometry. It's like there's a bubble rising and there's a trail right behind it. It's as if, you know, it's been lifted.
Okay.
What is this level of entropy in a consequence for a general IGM? You have the AGS doing their thing in the general IGM as well. This is a noticeable effect of, if you adopt a value of 200 for the entropy, and just assume that
there'll be too much energy to do it everywhere.
No, you cannot put everything. I just mean if you smear out the energy per photon that you would have in order to be consistent with so many AGNs going on in a cluster, would that have any general IGN?
I think you'd be spread you'd have two possibilities. If, as Piero mentioned, if you have AGNs going off everywhere, pumping out this level of energy, then you'd be you'd be affecting a lot of things, like destroying the filaments, the Lyman alpha filaments, for one.
You have to assume that AGN activity is really
concentrated, and I think that seems perfectly fine, because you look at Lyman break galaxies and they are strongly clustered, so you have these centers well established. If you look at numerical simulations, the region of putative cluster at redshift zero is already well established at redshift five. There's high concentrations of galaxies. Yeah.
Okay.
So I think that that part fits in nicely.
Okay, Paul, last question.
It's two parts. But it's really maybe the same question, just in two different disguises. One is that the statement, I've heard colleagues make the statement that all normal clusters, whatever that means, have a massive CD galaxy at the center.
Yeah.
And I didn't hear much about the CD galaxy as it related to your analysis. The second point, though...
Oops. Go back.
Back! Is that the duty cycle of quasars is quite short compared to the lifetime of the cluster. And so if you're depending upon the quasar activity to do any kind of heating, as opposed to preheating, which may not be your model, how does that work? Are we capturing quasar clusters in a special moment?
To answer your first question, quote-unquote regular clusters is a statement that is also biased in the sense that the subtext is that non-cooling flow clusters are not regular clusters. And that picture comes from this tacit anecdotal belief that all non-cooling flow clusters are remnants of mergers or are actively disrupted merger systems. And we've been having a lot of tough time, for example, and I mentioned this, Andy, for example, takes me to task. And so I've been forced to go to the X-ray data now, actually look at these images, and have come up with a subset of systems that are perfectly relaxed and are non-cooling flow. So they exist. And that's the first, you know, piece of argument that I'm starting to put together that suggests that there are systems that are perfectly relaxed and are non-cooling flows. And yet there are also...
They don't have CD galaxies.
And they don't have CD galaxies. Yes, they don't. Because if you never had that... And my argument would be that if you've never had that central cooling phase in to begin with, you could have a distributed energy, and that's it. For your second thing is, if you have your CD galaxy in the center, I haven't given much thought to the duty cycle bit, but you do see, for example, these are cooling flow clusters where you have energy output coming in from the center. So you do have a central CD galaxy, and you have some sort of AGN activity going on there. And at least from an observational point of view, this seems to suggest that the beast is being fed, and in turn it is reacting back. And now
all quasars that are active are in places like that. Then the fact that the activity is a small duty cycle makes you think that it must be very lucky to find those quasars. I mean, those clusters.
Yet, as far as I know,
much longer.
As far as I know, most cooling flow clusters seem to have this kind of activity.
In the radio source, lasts longer than an optical quasar. I mean, if you inject, if you inject energy over, hundreds of kiloparsec scale, and then you have no thermal energy injection, then you need to compute the cooling time of those electrons. That can go on for quite a while.
I see the outburst might have been
so
short,
sometimes that's right.
Still
that's
out
right.
There.
That's right. So you inject the energy, but then that propagates away, and the cooling time is longer.
Yeah, and in fact, the way to distribute that energy is to have these bubbles basically floating up, and so as they're floating, they're interacting with the surroundings and heating and distributing the heat. The engine has already shut off. But what's also interesting is that in some of these clusters. I think this may be one of them. There are actually evidence of multiple bubbles, so some seem to suggest age, and people have tried to estimate the duty cycle based on seeing previous bubbles and recent bubbles, and I haven't kept up with that very much.
Okay, thank you.